in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by a grant from International Galleries in Urbana's Lincoln Square Mall, offering crystal balls, dancing dolphins, pewter wizards, dragons, and fairies. International Galleries also offers custom framing services for your fine art print, posters, photos, needlework, and fabric art. Rush service is always available.
Good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. Tomorrow morning on the program, Jack Brighton will be sitting in once again as host. In the first hour, it's our monthly show on personal finance, and David Sinnoh will be here. He's clinical professor of finance at U of I. Once a month, he's on the show and talks about money management. So if you have those sorts of questions, you're welcome to call. In the second part of the program, the guest is Carol Lindquist. She's a marriage counselor, and we'll be talking about some of what you will find in her book. It's titled Happily Married with Kids. It's not just a fairy tale. Talking about how marriages can survive and stay happy and healthy with children in the picture. That's tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the philosophy of nonviolence and how that can be used to motivate social action and social change. Our guest for the program is Arun Gandhi. He is the founder of the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. It's based in Memphis, and he is one of the grandsons of the great Indian leader Mahatma Gandhi. He grew up in South Africa. As a young man, he went back to India, where he had spent some time earlier living with his grandfather, and we can tell that story in just a moment. He worked as a journalist. He was a reporter for the Times of India. He also founded the Center for Social Unity, an organization interested in dealing with issues of poverty and caste discrimination in India. In 1987, he came to the United States, and he continued to have the same kind of interest. He was interested in using nonviolence as a way to improve human relations. And 4 years later, in 1991, he and his wife founded the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence to help reduce violence in all phases of life, in the daily life of individuals, in homes, in society at large. And he's talking with us this morning by telephone, and we're glad that he could give us some of his time. I will mention, too, and I'll give you a little bit more information about this later, that for people who are in Champaign-Urbana and who are interested in the issue and learning about nonviolence, there will be a workshop sponsored by a number of community organizations March 5th and 6th dealing with this. Mr. Gandhi is not part of this directly, but we thought it would be a good opportunity to talk about the subject and then mention this workshop. So for people who are in Champaign-Urbana and around Champaign-Urbana, that's something that you can take part in if you're interested. And we'll tell you more about that later. Questions are welcome to 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Mr. Gandhi, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, thank you very much for giving us your time. Mm-hmm. To begin, perhaps I would ask you to talk a little bit more about the Institute and what it is all about.
Yes, well, as you had mentioned in the introduction, the Institute was started in 91, and we initially wanted to offer credit courses so that we could teach the philosophy of nonviolence to young people. But then the university said that they won't allow me to teach because I don't have a doctorate. And so we had to shift the focus from teaching credit courses to informal teaching. And that's what we've been doing now for almost 12 years, teaching the philosophy of nonviolence through workshops, seminars, conferences, lectures, you know, just any means possible. Mm.
And I know that you do that there and also do a lot of traveling and have spoken.
Yes, I do. I do a lot of traveling. Mm.
I think people might be interested in hearing the story of a little bit of the story of your youth, at least as I have read it. As you were growing up in South Africa, you had a problem with some bullying and decided that the way to deal with it was obviously to meet force with force, and you decided if you got strong, you'd be able to take care of anybody who would be pushing you around. And when your parents sort of got to understand what was going on, they apparently thought it would be a good idea for you to go and spend some time with your grandfather.
Uh-huh.
And you did live with him for a year, I guess. In India, and learned a lot from him. Maybe I would ask you to tell that story.
Yeah, that was a very important thing in my life. I think, you know, growing up in an apartheid South Africa with all that prejudice and hate was a very trying thing. And I was just 10 when I was subjected to violence. I was beaten up by some white youths and then some black youths, and both the times because of the color of my skin. And I reacted like everybody else would in a normal course. I was very angry, and I wanted to vent that anger through violence. And I began to show that in my attitudes, and that's when my parents decided to take me to India. And I think one of the first and the most important lessons that I learned from my grandfather, and I think which we need to teach to all young people and older people, is about understanding anger and trying to use that energy positively rather than abusing it. The thing is that we become angry because of something that happened or did not happen, and then we abuse that anger and cause violence, and it doesn't help anybody at all. But grandfather taught me that anger is like electricity. It's just as useful and just as powerful, but only if we use it intelligently. But it can be just as deadly and destructive if we abuse it. So just as we channel electricity and bring it into our lives, we must channel anger in the same way so that we can use that energy for the good of humanity rather than for the abuse or destruction of humanity.
Mm.
And he showed me several ways in which I could do this, and I've been doing that ever since, and I think it helped me considerably in learning how to channel that energy into positive action.
Mm. For a great many people, your grandfather is a great hero. I wonder whether, though, in your life, you have felt that bearing the Gandhi name confers on you some responsibility, in a sense, to carry on his work and his way of thinking.
Oh, yes, it certainly does. I mean, I feel that I have a legacy. I learned a lot from him and understood a lot about life, because my father was the only one of the four sons who committed himself completely to practicing nonviolence. And I think that it would be very sad if I let that legacy die with me. I think I should share the legacy with as many people as possible so that they can benefit from it the way I did.
Has that ever been difficult? I seem to recall reading a comment in one of the articles that I read about you.
Yes, it was when I was growing up and when I was a teenager.
Uh-huh.
It seemed like a burden, and sometimes I felt that why should I be carrying this burden? And that's when my mother told me that, it's entirely up to you. There's no way you can, discard this burden. It's there. So either you consider it a burden and you'll carry it all your life and it'll become heavier and heavier, or you can consider it to be a light that is illuminating your path and making it easier for you to see ahead. And I think that was a wonderful piece of advice. So I've been looking at this legacy as a light that is illuminating my path for me.
What was it that led you to decide to come to live in the United States?
Well, it was a combination of several circumstances. I mean, I didn't even plan. I had no idea absolutely that I would ever come to the United States and settle here. But it was while I was working in India with my friends and my wife and doing the work of the Center for Social Unity. It just, you know, we had a visitor from the United States who came to see our work there, and we were having dinner. And on this, you know, while discussing at dinner table, the idea just suddenly occurred to me. I said, wouldn't it be interesting to do a comparative study of prejudices? I suffered color prejudice in South Africa, where it is purely color-based. It had nothing to do with race or any other things. Then I went to India, and I came closely in touch with the caste prejudice, where we have no physical distinctions, and yet we have found ways in which we consider some people to be low-caste untouchables. And I said the race prejudice in the United States is against a group of people and not even the whole race. So I just wanted to do a comparative study and write a book on it. And, you know, it was just a flash in the pan kind of idea that came to me over the dinner table, and I expressed it not knowing that the lady I was talking to was on the board of the University of Mississippi. And so the next thing I hear from the university 4 months later that they would offer me a fellowship to come here and do the study. And that's how I came here. And it was a one-year fellowship. It just went on, and we just lived here and started this institute.
Hmm. I read a story about you. I came across a story about you that was published in Newsweek magazine in 1989. When you had been here not much more than a year, that made it sound like you weren't always welcomed, and that in fact that not only did you face hostility from people, from white people who were racist, but people within the civil rights community weren't necessarily welcoming. Apparently you made some comments about things like, well, maybe it wouldn't be such, maybe instead of spending money to build monuments to civil rights, maybe we should take that money out and actually do something with it. And in this particular article, it mentions the fact that someone who was an official of the NAACP basically said you should go home and mind your own business.
Yes. Yes, that did come about. And, you know, it was perhaps my fault, I don't know. But what I was trying to suggest to people here was that the philosophy of nonviolence is about helping people who are in need rebuild their self-respect and self-confidence. And so when we have a lot of poverty and oppression in this country also, instead of just feeding them through soup kitchens and taking care of their daily needs, I suggested that we ought to look into how we can make them productive citizens themselves and make them, you know, and we had done this through the Center for Social Unity in India for so many years, and the program was very successful. So I suggested that they look into this program and see if it is feasible for application here, and I think they didn't appreciate that very much, and some of them told me to mind my own business and go back to India.
That seems a little ironic given how important nonviolence and perhaps also some of the ideas of your grandfather were to the civil rights movement and to Dr. King particularly.
Yes, it is. It is very ironic and sad, but then people have their own views. There are others on the other hand who appreciated the advice very much and even have been looking into various aspects of it. So I wouldn't say that all of the civil rights leaders were opposed to it. There were a few, especially in Mississippi.
Well, perhaps we shouldn't dwell here on the negative. I'll introduce again our guest. We're talking with Arun Gandhi. He's the founder and president of the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence that's now located in Memphis, hosted by Christian Brothers University there. And if you're interested, by the way, and you have Internet access, they do have a website that you can look at. And questions, too, are welcome. 333-9455, toll free. 800-222-9455. I realize that a question like the one I'm about to ask is big, but I'll ask it anyway, and that is, how does one go about teaching peace?
Well, we need to first of all understand what we mean by peace. Today most of us seem to think that peace is the absence of war. That as long as we are not at war with somebody or not fighting with somebody, that we are living in peace. And Grandfather said that we commit violence in many, many different ways, in sometimes ways in which we don't even recognize as being violent. And the important thing for us individually as well as collectively is to do some introspection and see how we commit violence in society, in what, multiple ways. Now, there are many acts of physical violence that we commit, and they are obvious because we take note of it all the time. They are all the wars and killings and beatings and murders and rapes and all of these things where we do things to people using physical violence against them. But there are many acts of passive violence where we don't use any physical force, but nevertheless we hurt people in one way or the other. And that is what we need to understand and recognize. And it's only when we are able to recognize the passive violence within each one of us that we would be able to correct that and make a change. Mm. And Grandfather explained to me, he said, it is passive violence that fuels the fire of physical violence because it causes anger in the victim. And therefore, if we want to put out the fire of physical violence, we have to cut off the fuel supply. And that comes from each one of us. So unless we become the change we wish to see in the world, we can't really, work for peace.
Give me an example of passive violence.
Well, there are many, many examples, hundreds of them, but one of the things that I learned, and this happened to me when I was living with Grandfather, and through a little pencil. One day I was coming back from school and I had a 3-inch butt of a pencil, and I thought to myself, I deserve a better pencil, this is too small for me to use, and so I threw it away because I was so sure that Grandfather would give me a new pencil. But that evening when I asked him for a new pencil, instead of giving me one, he subjected me to many questions. He wanted to know why I threw it away and where I threw it away and so on. And finally, he made me go out and search for the pencil and bring it to him. And I must have spent about 2 hours searching for it. And when I brought it to him, he said, now I want you to sit here and learn 2 very important lessons. The first lesson is that even in the making of a simple thing like a pencil, we use a lot of the world's natural resources. And when we throw them away, we are throwing away the world's natural resources. And that is violence against nature. And the second lesson is that because in an affluent society we can afford to buy all these things in bulk, we overconsume the resources of the world. And because we overconsume them, we are depriving people elsewhere of these resources, and they have to live in poverty, and that is violence against humanity. Mm. And that was the first time I realized that all these little things that we do every day, consciously and unconsciously, the things that we waste and throw away because we have so much of it, the overconsumption of resources, the overconsumption of things that are available to us, all of these are acts of passive violence. And it's only when we understand the depth of the passive violence that we commit that we will be able to change our attitudes and our way of life.
I would imagine for a lot of people, what you're essentially asking people there to do is to slow down long enough to actually start thinking about what it is they do and the implications, that might indeed be one of the most difficult things for people
to do.
Well,
certainly it is difficult, but, philosophers have told us for ages that an unexamined life is not worth living, that we need to examine our lives, we need to examine our goals, and we need to see where we are going so that we can make the corrections that are necessary. So this is nothing more than just examining our lives and putting our values in proper perspective.
I guess the another thing that I can imagine some people saying, and when they would meet you or listen to you, they would say, well, maybe you can do this, and certainly your grandfather could do this, but I am not up to this challenge. It's too hard. How do you talk to that person who says, well, your grandfather was a very special man, and not everyone can live that way?
Well, yes, I have had people who say that to me, and I return my reply to that question is always that there is, history has shown us that there's been nothing impossible for human beings when they have the determination to do it. I mean, many things that we once thought were impossible to achieve today are commonplace, and we have made it possible because somebody had the determination to do it. So we all have that determination, and it's only a question of putting that determination into use and making things possible. To say that, I can't do it, but that somebody else has the power to do it, I think is a cop-out.
Hmm. We're getting close to our midpoint here. One thing I particularly want to mention here, as I introduce again the guest, is that there'll be a workshop on nonviolence taking place on March 5th and 6th here in Champaign-Urbana. Mm. And part of our reason for wanting to have this conversation at all is to tell people that this is going to be going on. It's sponsored by a local coalition of groups, all of whom are interested in peace and social justice, the Fellowship of Reconciliation. And they're having this workshop that they're calling From Violence to Wholeness, March 5th and 6th. They will be doing things like looking at the history and principles of active nonviolence, and then they'll do a number of other things in small groups. And this is happening at the Channing Murray Foundation on Oregon Street in Urbana. There are a long list of sponsors. Channing Murray is one of them, and I hope the other folks will forgive me if I don't read them all. But this is taking place there at Channing Murray, March 5th and 6th. And if you'd like to get more information on this or get a brochure explaining what it's all about, they say you can call Pat Fettig, and her number is 356-8136. It's the kind of thing I'm sure that many people listening will be interested in finding out about, that's the way that you can get the information. So if you're interested, you certainly should look into it and think about participating. And as I mentioned here this morning, our guest, Arun Gandhi, is the founder of the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. It's founded in 1991 by Mr. Gandhi and his wife. He's one of the grandsons of the great Indian leader Mahatma Gandhi, and it's an organization that does educational programs dealing with things like conflict prevention and anger management. He has traveled a great deal all around this country and all around the world talking about the ideas of his grandfather. And questions are certainly welcome if you'd like to give us a call. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here from Muhammad, a neighboring community, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've always been fascinated by the fact that Thoreau was inspired by Eastern texts, and then Gandhi was in turn inspired by Thoreau. I wonder if your guest would care to speak to what sort of influences Thoreau and his on civil disobedience had with Gandhi.
Did you, Mr. Gandhi? Did you get the question?
Not quite clearly.
I think that the question. Well, the caller was pointing out that there might be some interesting similarities in the thinking of Thoreau and of your grandfather, and was wondering if your grandfather was aware of Thoreau, interested in him, in influenced by him in any way.
Well, yes, that question did come up in his lifetime, and he said that he learned about Thoreau only several years after he started his civil disobedience in South Africa. And it's the first time he read the book Civil Disobedience was in the prison, and he was very happy to know that an eminent philosopher like Thoreau was thinking on the same lines as he was. And so I wouldn't say that he was directly influenced by him, but he was certainly very grateful for the support and the ideas.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I didn't really realize it was that way. So that was very interesting. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Mm-hmm. Well, what for you, Mr. Gandhi, what would you say were the most fundamental sources of ideas for your grandfather? Certainly, he drew on a number of different traditions, faith traditions. That he would have known. What do you think are the most important sources of his thinking?
Well, I think the real turning point in his life, and he says this in his own biography, was when he experienced the racial prejudice in South Africa, when he was picked up and thrown off the train because of the color of his skin. That was in 1893. And he was so angry by that humiliation that he wanted to retort with anger, and that was violence. And so he stopped himself and he said, there has to be a different way of getting justice. And so the next thought that came into his mind was to leave South Africa and go back to India. And he rejected that also because he said that is running away from a problem and not facing it. And that's when the idea of seeking justice through nonviolent action dawned on him. And he says that that was the real turning point in his life. But I think, you know, all the influences that he had in his childhood with spiritualism and religious teachings, you know, we are Hindus, but we are also very open and we are willing to learn from other faith traditions. And that's what he did. He said a friendly study of all the scriptures is the sacred duty of every individual. And he made that friendly study, and he found that all the religions of the world contained nuggets of truth. Nobody had the whole truth. And so he said, by studying all the religions with an open and friendly mind, we are able to extract the little truth from each one of them and incorporate that in our own lives, so that we can come closer to the whole truth there. And so I think the difference between what he believed in and what we believe in is that we think that we possess the truth and therefore we don't need to look for it anywhere else, whereas he believed that we can only pursue the truth. And so he always had an open mind and he was always pursuing the truth. And therefore, you know, being able to absorb many things through that pursuit. So I think the major influence in his life was religion and scriptures. And that really brought to him the awareness of the power of nonviolence. And then, of course, I think as he practiced this philosophy and went on, he realized also how deep-rooted this culture of violence was in humanity, that we have made the culture of violence so much a part of our lives, every aspect of our lives determined by that culture of violence. And the only redemption for humanity is to change that culture of violence to a culture of nonviolence. And, you know, although many people seem to think that nonviolence is a negative thing because it's the opposite of violence, but it's not. If we just remove the hyphen from the word and make it one word, we will realize that mentally we see it very differently. And I tell people that actually violence is the negative part because violence brings out all the negative within us. All the hate and prejudice and this, you know, selfishness and self-centeredness and all of these negative attitudes emerge when we live in a culture of violence. But when we practice the culture of nonviolence, then all the positive things come emerge, and we are ruled more by respect and love and compassion and understanding and all these positive attitudes. So it's much better to allow positive things to emerge rather than being controlled by negative attitudes and negative feelings.
Do you think that if one says that you're going to adopt nonviolence as a philosophy, or you're going to try, that then the idea of justice, of equality, of pursuing those values automatically comes, that's going to be the next step?
Well, this is a lifelong thing. It's not something that you can switch on and off. And so it's not, that you say in these circumstances I will be nonviolent and in other circumstances I will not. It has to become a part of your nature, a part of your life, and it's something we have to work on all our lives. Because we are living so much and for so many centuries we have been conditioned by a culture of violence. So that, whenever we face a conflict, our first response is violent response. And that we think considered to be a normal thing. But if we begin to change and if we begin to adopt this culture of nonviolence, then gradually we make those changes in our attitudes and in our relationships, and we become more peaceful, more loving, respectful, and so on. So it is something that has to be done as a lifelong process. It has to be done with diligence and understanding and real commitment.
Let's talk with someone else who is listening in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, hello. I have two questions. The first question is that I have a quotation book that I refer to pretty often, and it claims this following quotation to be a Hindustani proverb.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to see if you were familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
It is that there is nothing noble about being superior to some other man. The true nobility is in being superior to your previous self. Unquote. Do you are you familiar with that as a Hindustani proverb?
No, I must confess my ignorance. I have not come across that, but I wouldn't be able to answer that question honestly.
Okay. It's one of my favorites. I think superiority or notions of superiority are behind a lot of violence.
Yeah. Well, wherever it comes from, it makes a lot of sense anyway.
Yeah. And I have another question, and that is from my very cursory familiarity with Gandhi's accomplishments and such, and I'm not a student of history or anything, but the more I think about it, from that point of view at least, it seems to be more a tale about Britain to me than it is about India. It just seems it could have easily been a disaster if Britain had been more willing to fire into crowds than it was. So my question...
Oh, they did. They did. They fired into crowds and they used all kinds of violence to quell the nonviolent struggle in India. So that's a wrong notion that the British were very kind and sympathetic. And of course there are examples that nonviolence has even worked against Hitler, where people have used it very successfully. And these have been quoted by Gene Sharp in his book, The Politics of Nonviolent Action. And there are several hundred instances, and there are these two or three against Hitler. Albeit there were small groups of people, but, we can't condemn a philosophy even before giving it a proper trial and effectively trying to use it.
So I take it my question was going to be, is do you agree that a country powerful enough to withstand the negative consequences of killing innocent people is a country in which nonviolence is probably going to be ineffective? Apparently you would not agree with that.
No, I mean, I'm sorry I didn't hear the full question. If you're saying that because America is a violent country, that we will not be able to adopt nonviolence, I think that is not right. I think any people or any group of people who have seen the extreme forms of violence would be the first to adopt nonviolence. It's only those of us who have not seen violence and not experience the horrors of violence that it doesn't matter to us one way or the other.
That sounds as if you're saying that the lack of realistic violence, say, in our media, is actually contributing to the problem.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. We have about 20 minutes, a little bit less than 20 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Questions are welcome. We're continuing to talk with our guest, Arun Gandhi. He's founder, president of the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, and that's what we're talking about, the philosophy of nonviolence and its practical application in daily life. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'm sure that people, when they hear you and when they talk with you about nonviolence and what it can do, pose difficult cases for you, set the bar really high and say, well, what about this? And if we talk about what is the most, probably for a lot of people, the most serious occasion of violence that we've had to deal with in this country in the last couple of years, it would be the terrorist attacks of September 11th. And I'm certain that people have posed this question to you. They'd say, well, Mr. Gandhi, how does nonviolence, what sort of advice does nonviolence give us when we're thinking about dealing with a problem like international terrorism?
Yes, I have often come across this, and my feeling about this is that while terrorism is bad and all kinds of violence is bad, we have to look at all these things in the total picture and not, look at these acts of violence independently. Unfortunately, today, because of our dominance by the culture of violence, we look at these situations independently. It's only when these terrorists did what they did on September 11th that we took note of terrorism in the world. And then we got all angry and worked up, and we wanted to destroy all the terrorists in the world then. And that's wrong, because I think, we have to stop and find out why are there people in the world who hate us and who want to do such things to us. And obviously there's something wrong in our relationship with the rest of the world there, and how can we improve this relationship so that these kinds of things don't happen to us anymore. So, I wrote an article, and unfortunately nobody wanted to print it, but I said that September 11th is not the time for us to seek revenge. It's the time for us to do some introspection, to find out all these questions, and to find out how can we improve our relationship with the rest of the world so that people don't want to destroy us, but people would be willing to befriend us. Instead, we launched a war. We declared a war against terrorism, and we've been bombing countries in parts of the world, and we are threatening to bomb other countries also if they don't behave. And this whole thing is, to me, a Pandora's box. How many people are we going to kill in the name of terrorism? And how do we identify terrorists? Because people don't go around wearing badges. And so we have to kill a lot of innocent people in the hope that we will be able to get rid of some terrorists. And instead of combating terrorism and reducing it, what we are basically doing is increasing terrorism against us.
I suppose it certainly is true that there's nothing like being a victim of violence to start when thinking about violence.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going along and you're sort of living your life and it's happening to somebody else, it's not as much of an issue. But when it happens to you, then it becomes an issue.
Then it becomes a big issue.
I think we do have another caller here we will include in Crystal Lake on our line number 4. Hello.
I agree that this terrorism is really caused by what we do in other countries, particularly with the corporations. Once it's cheap labor, like South Korea's had riots against austerity, and other countries too have had rebellions, and I think that's where we get so much violence. And even like the Chicago 7, it was the police that beat up the Vietnam protesters in Seattle recently. The protesters were peaceful, but it was the police that started it, and they used pepper spray, which is banned in war. But the police department is too violent, and in racism too, you get a lot of violence there because the minorities are beat up too much. So I think nonviolence would be good if the police could learn a little of that. And of course, there's a famous case of Rodney King. And then in Detroit, there was a case where the whites beat up a truck driver that was black. So it gets reversed, too. So we all have to, it's a good lesson, but it's mainly our government that sets the example of violence with our wars, constant wars, and as they say, a preemptive war. We want one war after another, not the people so much, but the top leaders, okay?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Mr. Gandhi, you want to reflect on that?
Well, I couldn't quite understand the whole question. Could you just give me a
I think that the point the caller was trying to make is that it's difficult to talk about nonviolence when you live in a country where violence is institutionalized and where sometimes even agencies of government, whether you're talking about war or whether you're talking about law enforcement, when violence is part of the way that they sometimes go about doing their business.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, this is part of the tragedy of the culture of violence. We have institutionalized violence because we have adopted culture of violence as our way of life. And so we have to pay the consequences of that. And we think that we can resolve all conflicts by violent means. And maybe some of them we can afford because it all depends on how much power you have and how many weapons of mass destruction you have to put fear in the opponent. And in a culture of violence, the control is always through fear. We have to keep escalating the level of fear to be able to maintain that control. What happened in WTO in Seattle was the same thing that happened in India when grandfather launched a struggle there. It was a nonviolent struggle, but the British used infiltrators. They used means to raise some act of violence to give them the justification to use violence against the whole movement. And that is part of this whole culture of violence. So, that is to be expected. And the reason why grandfather was successful in India was that he made sure that nobody was able to infiltrate his ranks and cause these acts of violence. And whenever there was an act of violence, he called off the whole struggle, the whole movement, and re-educated the people there. So it's a question, in Seattle what happened was there was no leadership. Everybody, all the groups had come together and all of them were working independently and so there was no leader who could take responsibility or give them directions. And this is what happens generally in acts of violence everywhere, that we are always kept under control and kept in good behavior by fear of the police, fear of the government, fear of the taxmen, fear of religion, fear of everything.
Let's go on. We'll talk with someone else here on our line 1 in Champaign County. Hello.
I wasn't able to listen to everything, but I don't know. I might disagree with you on the idea that a leader is important for a nonviolent movement. I think leaders come up out of the ranks, and the movement is more important than the leader. But I wanted to ask you about whether you talked about the World Social Forum, and there was one just in Mumbai, and whether you see that as a positive development, and what kind of things you would like to see.
Oh yes, I think it's a positive movement. I was there, and I went to the World Forum. It was like a big university with so many things happening at the same time and so many people there. But it was a very good thing, and I think it should be done on a regular basis all over the world there, so that we can inform people about various aspects. I do agree partly with what you said about leadership. Leaders do emerge from the people, and they take control of the movement. But, you know, you can't have groups of people working, on their own independently to, like the Seattle situation, where there was nobody accountable, nobody responsible, and everybody did whatever they felt like. When you have a movement like that, then it's going to be chaos, and it's not going to be properly led. It's like putting the army out into the field without any officers there to give them any directions.
Well, I don't know if you noticed what you attended at this World Social Forum. We definitely need to have one here. I guess these Chautauquas that are happening around are sort of like it, but it does get very little coverage. But one of the calls that came out of it from your fellow countrywoman, Arundhati Roy, was to look at ways that, and I think she ended up calling for some sort of complete boycott of U.S. cultural and other sorts of products. I don't know how that can be implemented, but there is a upwelling of opposition to the U.S. role in the world, and these are the people that are doing it as you advocate, nonviolently. But we ignore them at our peril, because if we don't, it seems to me, deal with those issues, the answer then comes in the form of nihilistic terrorism. So
yeah,
I appreciate your work. Thank you. I have to go. Bye. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Mr. Ghani, go ahead. You were going to comment.
Yeah, I was going to say that, these boycotts and things, calling for boycotts and eliminating people or keeping people away from the mainstream, I don't quite agree with all of those, the way they are being practiced today. We should not create a wall between us and them. The purpose of the nonviolent action is always to find a common ground where we can meet and discuss and try to educate and reform people and understand issues. But when we begin to create walls, and when we build up, that whole concept of us and them, then we are dividing the community and dividing the people and creating more conflicts there. So I don't agree with that kind of attitude or behavior. Which is not to say that, boycotts are bad totally, but we need to be very understanding in how we implement it and how we use that whole concept.
If people are going to adopt the philosophy of nonviolence and then be involved in activity for social change, They're going to have to be prepared, I would think. They would have to be prepared to be targets of violence themselves. Is that something that you...
Yes, that's going to happen. I mean, we can't transform this whole world after so many centuries of the culture of violence. Mm-hmm. It's not going to change overnight. People are not going to become very good and loving and respectful overnight. It's going to take a long, long time for us to transform this world. And during that time, we will have to be cautious, and we will have to contend with people who use some violence. But we ought to be able to reduce that level of violence to the bare minimum. I mean, you know, the more civilized we are becoming today, the more violent we are. And that's a tragedy. It's not normal. I mean, the two don't go together. So we need to understand what we mean by civilization. And if we really want to be civilized human beings, then we ought to be more respectful and loving and compassionate and understanding towards each other and not fighting and killing and destroying each other.
Mm. You really think it's true that it's not just a matter of having more tools to commit violence, that in fact we are more violent?
Yes, certainly having tools more easily available makes it easier for us to be more violent. I mean, I had a case of a prisoner who was in jail because he shot one of his friends, and it was a drug deal that went bad. And so I asked him this very simple question. I said, if you didn't have a gun, what would you do then? He said, I would have run for my dear life. So I said, now in retrospect, don't you think that it would have been much better you didn't have a gun and you could have run away and stopped all this from happening? And he said, yes. So, you know, that kind of thing is an indication that when we have weapons of violence available to us freely, we use them freely. And that only increases the level of violence.
We're going to have to stop. We've come to the end of our time. I wanted to mention once again for people who are here in Champaign-Urbana, there will be a workshop exploring nonviolence as a philosophy and how one puts that into action. It's taking place at the Channing Murray Foundation, March 5th and 6th. There are a number of sponsors, including Channing Murray, and a number of other groups in the community that are interested in peace, social justice, religious action. And if you're interested in finding out more about it, you should contact Pat Fettig, 356-8136. And also for people who are interested in finding out more about the Gandhi Institute, you can go to their website, which is www.gandhiinstitute.org. Our guest this morning, Arun Gandhi, founder and president of the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Memphis. Mr. Gandhi, thank you very much for talking
with us. Thank you for having me on your show.
That is it for us here on Focus 580. Tomorrow morning, Jack Brighton sitting in as host, talking about personal finance issues with Dave Sinnoh in the first hour. And then hour two, the guest is marriage counselor Carol Lindquist, and they will discuss her book, Happily Married with Kids, It's Not Just a Fairy Tale. She'll be here visiting in the community, and is going to be doing a book signing out at Pages for All Ages. So that's tomorrow. Hope you'll stay tuned, because up next, we have more news and weather and other things as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, it's the day we talk about computers. Computers and you today on the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news, the science and technology reporter for the News Gazette, Greg Klein. That's coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Let's take a look at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. Prices are higher. March wheat trading at 369 and a quarter, up 4 and 3 quarters. July wheat 370.